everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Women on War podcast. I'm your host, Jillian Drappel.
And I am your host, Alyssa Atkins. And as always, with our wonderful tagline, we are not your two average museum gals. We like to drink while we are doing our episodes and sling some jokes, as well as make some light and fun, maybe spilling the tea. But it's kind of what we're doing. And actually, we are trying not to spill some tea. This week, Jillian and I are both actually drinking tea. I'm having a hot toddy simply because I don't really feel well, and hot toddies are just happiness in a mug.
She doesn't have the Rona. Coffee. She doesn't have the Rona. So
once again, I don't have Rona.
Yay.
This is the second time we've had to clarify that I don't have coronavirus. It's allergies. It was like 63 degrees here today, and like yesterday it was 32, and then tomorrow it's supposed to be 32. So it's like,
meanwhile in Michigan it's like 9 degrees, and I'm just like that crazy person having a matcha green tea iced from Starbucks.
But sometimes you gotta do what you. Sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do. I think on my way home from Virginia Beach, I actually got a cold brew, and it was pretty cold, and I was like, I need to drink this fast, so I'm just gonna get it iced. And they like looked at me really weird, like, why don't you want hot coffee? But that's besides the point.
Hey, it's all good.
It is definitely besides the point. We are actually going to finish up our episodes, I guess, of Annie Etheridge. And if you are now just tuning in, Jillian, please kind of give us our synopsis of Annie and what we discussed in the first episode.
Absolutely. So Annie is a, you know, dare I say it, total badass when it comes to the Civil War, because, you know, not many people think that women served in the Civil War, but they did. Not everybody dressed as a male soldier. And she was openly dressed as a woman. She was what was called a daughter of the regiment or a vivandière. And she was a cook, a laundress, a nurse. Mostly her duties went towards frontline battle medics. She was on the front lines with the guys, tending to them. She was under fire, taking care of them. She was known throughout the regiments and the different companies, and she served with three different Michigan companies, the 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Michigan. She was in battles such as Gettysburg, Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg, both Bull Runs. So she did quite a lot of work, and she was married three times. Crazy, crazy times. And she's to kind of tie it all together, she is buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors, and she is one of two women to have that honor from the Civil War. So I think it's pretty powerful stuff that, you know, she did all that work, and then it was the men who recognized that she was an important factor in their survival and their history with the war, and she was just as much a part of the regiment as they were, and even though she carried no rank. So
I know we had discussed this, that she had no rank, but wasn't she about to get the rank of sergeant at one point?
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah. So it was actually at, I believe, the Battle of Chancellorsville, and she was tending to some men in the rocks during fire. She had carried some people to cover, and General Kearney actually came around and approved of the work that she was doing, was going to give her the rank of a sergeant and a sergeant's pay. And sadly, he was killed before he had that ability to do so. So she actually didn't carry any rank on paper, but all the men really respected her as if she did. So.
I feel it deeply saddens me, honestly, to think that she never necessarily had that rank on paper because of all of her, as I said last week, her acts of heroism, really. She, you know, especially because she was fairly petite, correct?
Yeah.
In her stature.
Yeah. She was roughly my height, was what I could find in the newspapers. She was pretty tiny herself. But she was headstrong, man. She was like, no, I'm going to walk. And they were like, no, you're riding this horse. And basically, like, forced a horse upon her. If it were me, I'd be like, okay, yes, please, thank you. But, you know, that's just me.
I'm imagining, just because you're about
I'm
five,
about five
three, five,
six.
four,
Yeah.
five. Okay, so okay, that's what you are actually a little bit taller. I'm the short one out of this duo. But just trying to imagine, like, I guess at the same time, I'm trying to imagine you, like, in reenacting having to, like, if you had to ever fireman carry, somebody who's like 6'1", and you're like trying to, like, but just imagining from knowing and understanding all of your research and my research about how strong, as you said, she was, I feel like she was really a force of nature and
Yeah.
just something that she was a type of woman, obviously, who, if she set her mind to it, she was like, oh, I'm doing it. I don't
Yeah.
care. Like, like the horse,
I mean,
like
I can
camel.
say now I want to clarify, like, for our listeners, like, what she was wearing. She in the 1860s, there is something called a riding habit. If you've ever seen, like, Victorian photos of women on horses, and they're like, it looks very much like a suit on the top, and then it's got this long skirt that trails off the side of the horse. That's roughly what she was wearing, because there was no uniform for her. So daughters of the regiments took on a female version of the men's uniform. So it could have been like a blue, like a navy blue color. Mine is that is navy blue. It could have been hunter green, or it could have been brown. I don't have any, like, really hard evidence of, like, what color it was. So going off of what the most popular colors in that time were, I just did navy blue. And then also through other daughters of the regiments, I looked at what they were wearing, how close it was to the men uniform, and I kind of adopted that towards hers. So I had to take some liberties with it. But she would take this long skirt and tuck it in her waistband and basically run around the battlefield in a long dress. And she was wearing pants underneath it. They would have like long pants that would band at either your ankle or just below your knee, like knickers at the time.
Okay.
So, if something were to happen, there's no mishaps or anything like that, because yes. So I can say, like, running around on a battlefield in a full skirt is very difficult, especially when, the guys are down and they're into the role playing sort of thing. Like, they want to give the crowd a good show. So they roll around on the ground and they, scream, or, I may or may not be pushing on, like, a pressure point on their arm or something. But, they are really into the moment. And it's great, because as a female reenactor, you don't always get that experience. They just kind of, like, sit there and you're like, oh, are you okay? Would you like some ice? No, you're good. All right. It's like a term in the hobby called ice angels. And a lot of the guys for a while thought that I was that. And I was like, no, Annie was not that. And I had to, like, really teach them about it. And so I've actually dragged a couple friends around the battlefield, and I feel bad, because they would get, like, skirt, like, kicking them in the face, because I'm, like, trying to, like, drag them in the grass. And I feel bad. But they're like, no, that was hilarious, because we watched you just straight up, like, take him by, like, his leather straps from his kit and just, like, yank him halfway across the battlefield. We didn't think you would be able to do it. So I mean, when there's a will, there is a way, and I can't even imagine what hers was like.
I can just imagine such an amount of adrenaline as
Oh, yeah.
well, because with her being part of the 2nd, 3rd, and 5th, which were all infantry regiments, correct, if I remember correctly from Civil
Yeah.
War. And I know I said this all throughout last week, but, like, she truly lived up to the infantry's motto of follow me.
Yeah.
She would go out there and be like, the men would be like, oh, get back, Annie, get back. She'd be like, screw you.
Hell
Like,
no.
I'm gonna hair, not necessarily whipping in the wind, because it would be in a perfect Victorian bun, I would imagine. But however, though, what I know, she was very well respected all throughout the Union, but are there any, like, Confederate accounts of her on the battlefield that you know of, or
Not that I have found.
okay.
I believe there were a daughter of the regiments on both sides. I'm
Okay.
still doing research into it, because it is a fairly, it's not many people have researched it. Let me
Okay.
say that. I
I think
went to a
that's fair.
national event in Gettysburg about 2 summers ago now, and I met two other women that did daughter of the regiments. And
Okay.
I was so excited, because they were like, oh yeah, let's talk to other regiments. I mean, this girl had a daughter of the regiment, like, tattooed on her arm. Like,
she's
into it. And I'm like, that is amazing. Because there are some really big ones, like Mary Tappy, who is part of the Zouaves. And, you know, so there are some really famous ones out there that, but more along the counts of, like, the Union. But I'm sure there were some in the Confederacy. But I feel also like the Confederacy would have had their women's roles very, like, you are in the hospital sort of thing. Like, the battlefield is no place for you.
Very, very Victorian.
Very proper.
Yes. Yes. The very true proper Victorian. And I also feel, no offense knocking on Gone with the Wind, but they all had to be Scarlett O'Hara and the Seven Bells, minus the tight lacing of the corset. However, like, they had that specific role and they needed to stay, you know, within that hospital. I mean, you look at historical accounts or even films and really just even television shows. And I don't know why this came to mind, but Mercy Street.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, the historical inaccuracies. That's a topic for another day.
But, you know, there is a scene in Mercy Street where that Southern gentleman's oldest daughter, who was in love with that pastor and everything, she goes to the battlefield. And there's a scene where they need the fighting to stop because there is a man that is, you know, dying in the center of the battlefield. And she wanted to save him. She literally stands up on a stone wall. And she puts herself in harm's way. And the men realize, they're like, hang on, that's a woman. You can't shoot at her. And so they literally stop the fighting in the scene so that she can go and get the man and drag him across the wall.
That, I don't remember that scene.
Because in their mind, they would not shoot at a woman.
That is so interesting. Yeah. And I mean, I guess it takes it to a whole new, or at least a deeper level or a deeper dynamic, and how women were treated, you know, throughout the Civil War. And I know, spoiler for all of you for next week's episode, how we talked about that too, even well into the Second World War. So it's really interesting looking at women's roles, specifically, even though Annie and others fully proved that they were more than capable of, you know, doing the things that these men did. Granted, well, I wouldn't even say then that, and I'm sure some marine actor friends can please tell me if I'm wrong, but the kits for the Civil War reenacting isn't necessarily that heavy. Like, I would imagine it wouldn't be that heavy compared to other reenacting. Am I wrong, or?
I don't think so. I would actually say that, like, my kit for Civil War reenacting is heavier than my World War II kit, just because running around on the battlefield, like with World War II, and that might change when I build up my Army Nurse Corps impression, but they had lots more pockets in World War II than they do with Civil War, because pockets are a thing, I mean, man. I'll tell you what.
Okay.
But
I was going to say, on the topic. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine.
We were talking about pockets, and so I was curious if your riding habit has pockets in it.
Yes, I am what we call a farb in the hobby. And so I got my first Annie outfit for free, and I kind of like doctored it up and made it more work and took a lot of things off. At the time, I was not the best seamstress. I'm like getting better as I look at like this 40s blouse that I just made like this week. And I could not make pants to save my life. When I was taking things off, I was very novice. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go and buy a pair of scrubs from Walmart and chop them off the knees and put in a ribbon at the bottom. And that's what I wear for my Annie, like, riding hat. Because first of all, if you're looking at my riding habit, quote unquote, bloomers, you are way too close. Sick COVID rules. Annie, 6 feet, sir.
Annie, I feel like Annie afterwards would have kicked somebody.
Kinda. Yeah.
You were too close, good sir.
Yeah. Back away. Now, I did remake it, and I had what was, you know, tropical weight wool, something more appropriate that they would have been wearing. Because for those of you who think, you know, why are you wearing all these layers in the middle of July? I wear about 6 to 7 layers of clothes with my Annie outfit. A lot of people are like, what are you doing? That is insane. I did actually, at that same event in Gettysburg two summers ago, I actually did have heat stroke for like 2 days. It was not fun, I will say that. I missed most of that event, but it was okay. And, you know, I actually like learned a lot of lessons with that redo of the uniform. One, it looked better, but the material wasn't that great. And it led me to thinking, well, what would Annie actually have access to? Because there are four photos, that I know of her that exist. One is in the riding habit when it looks like she first joined. Another one is of her in like a plaid shirt and like a white skirt, and then, or a light colored skirt. And then the other two are of her after the war. And in every single photo, except for the first photo, I believe, she's wearing her Kearney Cross, which she was awarded by General Kearney for distinguished bravery on the battlefield. I try to like recreate to the best of my ability what I think she would have worn. And, you know, that could change in the next coming years as I do more research, because I want it, you know, to be as authentic as possible. I do run into some challenges. Like, Annie had a horse. She kept all of her belongings in saddlebags. I do not have a horse. And unless I, you know, drive my car on the battlefield and like put saddlebags like on the side of my car. But that's not very, right? And so I just like carry a haversack, and I carry, you know, a U.S. military belt, because I believe as she would have gone throughout the war, she would have picked up personal items along the way and had gotten hand-me-downs from the men. So if she needed a belt, she carried two pistols and a saber for her protection. And she carried like her personal belongings in the saddlebags. So I have a gun belt, like a U.S. belt issued military. And one of the guys I know like let me borrow like a little pistol for my protection. So I'm still building up, but I'm hesitant to like buy anything until I do more like solid research behind everything. So that was a long-winded answer on what I wear, but there it is.
That's okay. I mean, I think it will give people a visual as well, especially if you wanted to hint, drop a picture of your
we'll definitely
you know, reenacting with Annie, so that way some people can get a good visualization. Mm-hmm. Just because you have to speculate and do your research based on like other women in the era. Mm-hmm. However, though, because I know you had mentioned the Kearney Cross, after the war, what was her pension like? Because she is buried in Arlington, so she has full military honors with that. But how did her pension come about, and what was her pension specifically after the war?
Yeah, so Annie, I think, really clicked with Washington, D.C., because after the war, she stayed in Washington, D.C., or she moved back there, and she got married to her third husband, Charles E. Hooks, and he was a Connecticut veteran. And he had lost one of his arms in the war. And so she had worked at the Treasury office 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. She was, I mean, work ethic like nobody's business. And at the time, there was a law, because of so many veterans coming back out, all these men are coming back and wanting their jobs back, and the women have to, you know, go back home and everything like that. With that law, it was only one person in the household can work for the U.S. government. Normally went to the head of the family. So Charles Hooks, her third husband, was a one-armed watch repairman at the Navy Yard. So I'm not sure how he did that, but more power to him. So because of that, having a government job, Annie lost her job. And so the men of the 2nd, 3rd, and 5th that were left wrote to Congress talking about her acts and her bravery, because Annie didn't want the recognition, I don't believe. I think she was just doing it because she felt called to do it. And so the men wrote to Congress and basically said, you know, this woman did 4 years of service without any recognition. She was a volunteer strictly. She almost became a sergeant. These are all of the accounts that she was in. These are all the battles that she was in. I mean, men were writing home about her all the time. So people knew about her. And she got awarded $50 a week by the Congress. And they, after they awarded it, they reduced it to $25.
Okay.
So her pension was cut in half, but she still got a pension of $25.
Is there a specific reason why her pension was cut in half?
I have yet to find that out. But yeah, I have nothing along those lines. But speaking of, you know, how people are talking about her, I just want to read this letter real quick by an Ohio soldier who was dying and wrote to her. It's like one of the very few letters that we have in existence, like to Annie specifically. And it was written on January 14th, 1864. And it says, "Annie, dearest friend, I am not long for this world, and I wish to thank you for your kindness ere I go. You were the only one who was ever kind to me since I entered the army. At Chancellorville, I was shot through the body, the ball entering my side and coming out through the shoulder. I was also hit in the arm and was carried to the hospital in the woods where I lay for hours and not a surgeon would touch me. When you came along and gave me water and bound up my wounds. I do not know what regiment you belong to, and I do not know if this will ever reach you. There is only one man in your division that I know. I will try to send this to him. His name is Strachan, orderly sergeant in 63rd Pennsylvania Volunteers. But should you get this, please accept my heartfelt gratitude, and may God bless you and protect you from all dangers. May you eminently be successful in your present pursuit. I enclose a flower, a present from a sainted mother. It is the only gift I have to send to you. I know nothing of your history, but I hope you always have and always may be happy. And since I will be unable to see you in this world, I hope I may meet you in that better world where there is no war. May God bless you both now and forever is the wish of your grateful friend, George H. Hill from Cleveland, Ohio."
My heart!
Right? And then, to make matters even worse, the letter never actually got to Annie by Strachan because he himself had been killed and the letter was found on his body and then was delivered to Annie.
Oh,
like, that's
man.
How, that is how well she was known, because they were like, oh, this is addressed to Annie Etheridge. Get this to her.
Mm-hmm.
But I read that letter the very first time I was doing research on Annie, and I remember just feeling so just, one, awestruck, and then two, at the same time, I was just so humbled.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That is a true testament to her character. It's mm-hmm. not just as, you know, a Vendier, but as a soldier, I feel like,
yeah.
because I will consider her a soldier because she was part of the regiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's part of everything, and she did, while she might have not killed anybody, you know, she's very much a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm very pissed about her pension.
I know. Like, I know. I really read that the first time and it was like, excuse me, say what? And then if you want to take it up a notch. So there are two sides of reenacting. There's a mainstream side and there's a progressive side. Mainstream is you buy like your uniform and you get your kit and it's not totally authentic. There are some pieces that are made in China and you're okay with that, whatever, if it's your budget, great. And you have fun with it, great. There's nothing wrong with mainstream reenacting. And then you have people who are progressives who are make their entire uniform. They buy everything American made. They have, you know, people who, you know, literally learn blacksmithing skills to make their own items or whatever. And they're very authentic with it. And I don't know where they get all the money, but good for them. And there are some groups out there who are very authentic and they're like, no, we're only going to do it this way and this way and this way because that is how they did it. So as, you know, a researcher, I wanted to reach out to one of the groups and was like, hey, this is what I do. And this is, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I'm looking to build up my kit. Do you have any advice for me? And I literally got this message back that said, if I didn't have proof that it actually happened, I wouldn't do it. Does that make sense? And I was like, and I didn't do this like menacingly or anything. I was just curious to see if that was enough information and evidence that she did what she did. I was like, well, I have her pension and I have her Arlington burial papers and I have her will and I have accounts from men saying where she was and I have this letter from a dying soldier that she was there and I have 80 other things that I could list, but I won't because it'll take too long. Is that enough like research and evidence that she was there? And I literally just got a thumbs up message. Because again, it goes along the lines of some men just do not want to accept that there were women there because reenacting is a boys' club.
It's
it is. And with especially with like Civil War, it's not the same mm-hmm. so much with Revolutionary War. I don't know what that is like because I don't do it. World War II, it's a lot different because you have women in military roles, you have women in civilian roles, and everybody's okay with that because mm-hmm. they all want to learn more about that. But for some reason, I've come across a lot of people who are really against it, and I've come across a lot of people who are really for it. And lucky enough, I'm a military commander. I'm the only female military commander in the state of Michigan, and I've been blessed to have a colonel of our, you know, brigade be very on board mm-hmm. with it. And he's like, I think this is great. As long as you have solid research, I think this is great. So.
And I think that it's so impeccable and just wonderfully, I'm going to say brilliant. And I sound very English for saying that, but like, it's, that's how it should be.
Yes.
Because I think, and I'll say this, and quite honestly, to visitors, or not visitors, but like listeners, if this strikes a chord with you, I'm going to say good, because then I know I'm doing my job as a historian, first and foremost, not just as a podcaster, mm-hmm. but women have had so many roles throughout history, and the fact that so many historians have written these women, such as Annie, out of history is yeah. very mind-boggling. And it really comes down to the fact that we're more than capable.
Yes.
You know, we are more than capable than serving in these roles. And I think that's when we really see the progression throughout wars, right? Mm-hmm. Women, I will say, to dive, because I know you mentioned briefly the Revolutionary War, women were in espionage. Women were literally in espionage. Yeah. That's what they were used for. And without women in espionage, the Revolutionary War would have not favored the Patriots. Like, let's be real. I mean, mm-hmm. we will get into pretty deep with Anna Strong, which is my girl.
Yeah.
Next to Joan Clark. But
and
you know, there's
to piggyback off that, just because I know we're running out of time too, is there were a lot of women in Washington, D.C. who did that as well. They would carry messages in their hoop skirts. And there, even in the House of Davis.
Yeah.
And there was a free woman who literally put herself back into slavery and worked in the Davis household.
And it's just, I think what we're really trying to get is the only reason why we know this is because we have so much access to all this research now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we can go into the Library of Congress and we can do this. We can go through JSTOR, all of our things. And truly, I mean, honestly, when we discuss doing this, or this like segment really on the baddest women mm-hmm. of war, you know, whether it's through espionage, cryptography, Vivian, I can't even say it.
Vivandier. it's French.
Words.
Right.
I think it's something really important. And this is, you know, I think really the force for this podcast. And so really, Annie Etheridge was a badass through and through.
Yeah.
Truly lived up to the motto of follow me, I think more than most men did in the Civil War.
Yeah. And I think she's just the tipping point of all the badass women that we are going to talk about. And so, like, you know, Alyssa said, little teaser for you guys next week. We're going to hop over into World War II and talk about our Russian friends over in World War II. Is that politically correct to say nowadays? I don't know. Whatever. They were badass Russian women. But we will see you guys next week.
With Rachel Box.